Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome back Benny Tedesco, director and producer of the documentary film The Wrecking Crew. The Wrecking Crew were an elite group of studio musicians that played many of the hits in the 1960s in Los Angeles. Along with Denny, we also welcome back Don Randy, one of the members of The Wrecking Crew. Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Flizzo to the Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We have a great show for you tonight. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I am doing fine. Happy Memorial Day, everyone out there.
Yes, I just want to say for those who have served, for those who are serving, and those who have died serving our country, thank you for keeping us safe and free. And may all those that are serving right now get the chance to get home as soon as they can, safe with their families as soon as possible. Because I appreciate their keeping us safe. Yes, Scott.
No, I just said absolutely. Agreeing.
So anyway, what's been going on otherwise?
Not a whole lot. I'm excited though. I'm be checking out the TC Electronics Helix Phaser. Will be coming my direction very soon, along with their Univibe, which is the Viscous Vibe. Their Univibe creation. So I'm pretty excited to check those out. And those both have tone prints on them. So they have already quite a bit of tone prints done by people at NAMM.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, we saw those at NAMM. They sounded really good. They're good pedals. I also have a pedal that I got from New Neighbor, and it has it's a delay echo, and then it does this kind of weird choral thing. So I'm going to try it with my acoustic guitar. I've been playing around with it a little bit. So I'm hopefully going to have – they're local, so I'm going to try to get them on the show and have them bring in all their system. The cool thing about New Neighbor is you can go online, and the pedals are like a standard circuit. And you can go on and you can download for free any of their pedals, and it works in the pedal. You can only use one at a time. But you could actually change your pedal into an echo, or you can change your pedal into a phaser. It's all software driven, so it's really,
are those pedals that have three knobs on them, I think, right?
Yeah, you can buy a generic one if you want, but I bought the one because I wanted this effect. I thought it was kind of cool with acoustic guitar, so I've been playing around with it a little bit. So anyway, that's I'll be reporting on that as I get better at it. I'm still messing around with it. So anyway, okay, well, listen, we got a lot to talk about. I'm really excited because the video is coming out now. It's official. They're going to be – the Wrecking Crew video is coming out. I want to talk about it because it's really cool, and it's on Blu-ray. So let's go ahead and go to commercial. When we get back, we're going to talk to Denny and Don.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here from Sweetwater. We're super happy to support Jeff and Scott and the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show on LA Talk Radio. You can see all the specs and pics of your favorite gear and amazingly low prices online at Sweetwater.com or call us at 800-222-4700. Every week, Jeff and Scott welcome heavy experts and industry mavens exploring the coolest guitars and basses, pedals, amps, strings, accessories, everything you need to rock. Sweetwater sells all that cool stuff, so listen to the Flow and then check it out online at Sweetwater.com or call one of our pro guitar enthusiasts at 800-222-4700. Don't forget that Sweetwater has 24 months equal payments, no interest financing available too. Check that out at the bottom of every Sweetwater webpage where it says easy financing and hit the red apply now button. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying rock on with the flow.
Hey, this is Brent Mason with Jeff and Scott, Flow Guitar Enthusiasts, and enjoyed being on the show, and hopefully we'll get together again, and I'm going to go to bed. It's late. Thanks, guys.
I had to play that one because he's the top session guy in Nashville right now.
It's Brent.
So
Brent's been a big supporter of this film. He actually was one of the first folks that actually dedicated a song on the DVD.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Anyway, I want to welcome both Denny Tedesco and Don Randy. They had come here almost 2 years ago.
Wow.
It's been that long.
Whoa.
Actually, it's over 2 years. And when they came on, they were just finishing up. You were just finishing up editing, if I'm correct. And you were getting ready. You were in the middle of your Kickstarter thing. And you were getting ready to get everything together. And it's been 2 years. Now, I've talked with you before because I've seen you over at NAMM. And what I want to ask you first off is some of the – I know that – I've dealt with licensing before and trying to get clearances and stuff, and it's a nightmare, especially a project like you have where you have so much stuff. I mean, and I think it was really cool that you insisted that everybody get paid, which is kind of cool for musicians. That's rare that people care enough to make sure that we're, you know, as working musicians, that we get paid for the work we do.
Wait, we paid the musicians?
But that wasn't,
what were we thinking?
That wasn't easy, in spite of the union.
Well, that's one of the things I want to talk about because it turned out that it took longer for the thing to get released, and I know people were upset. But you know, kind of explain what was happening so they can understand.
So what happened was for those who don't know, from the beginning, 96, we started the film. 2000, when my dad, Tommy Tedesco, was passing away, we started this film called The Wrecking Crew and kept going. We finally actually started and actually cut the film together in 2008. Mm-hmm. And we had at that point 100 songs, whatever it was. But we couldn't release until we paid for these songs or for all the music that was in there. And I was expecting, someone's going to, find out how successful this film is in festivals and go, we'll put the money down on the rest of the project, which is basically licensing music.
Mm-hmm.
2010 came around. We still didn't have anybody biting with all the great reviews, awards, and everything else. It got down to the point, what do we do? And I think that was the lowest point because no one's talking. And then it was a guy that said, why don't you dedicate songs? And it was a radio guy, Greg Organowski. And he said, dedicate a song. And I said, what do you mean? He says, I'll give you $1,000 right now for Up, Up, and Away. He says, because that song changed my life and brought me into radio. Because I was, as a kid, listening to radio when Up, Up, and Away on one station and turned it to another station and realized there was a difference between two stations. Well, that basically started donations from 2010. And we started doing, I would do fundraisers. I would go do, up north in Benicia, California, or anywhere I could show the film and possibly raise money, I would do it, take the money, turn around, pay off a label, pay off a publisher, start knocking down these bills. And during all this, I still had another bill from the musicians union because it was crazy. If we weren't, you could pay the labels and the publishers, but you need to pay the musicians for their work. And it's called the reuse. And it was, we always knew we had to do that. And as we're going along, we kept paying, and we finally got to the point where we almost paid off almost all the labels and publishers, but we had to pay off the union. And finally, the union came around and said, listen, we got, instead of $500,000, I think it would have been book rate, we'll do it for $200,000. Let's do it for two. And I was fine with that. Let's just do it, raise the final $200,000 on Kickstarter. And people thought it was crazy. And they said, that's a lot of money in Kickstarter. Only 1% ever make it on Kickstarter with over 100,000. But at that point, we've already done 3 years of building an audience. And it was musicians actually taught me this on the road. When they go into every club, they always try to get an email slip or you know, in the old days, it was just addresses. So you could mail somebody, you know, hey, we're playing in your city. And I would build up an audience. And finally, we had a Facebook page at that point, 23,000. Now we have 61. But at the time, we had 23,000 Kickstarter fans. We had 20,000 emails. I thought, you know what? If I don't go for it, why should I even try? Because I got to go for it. I can't keep coming back. So we knew we needed more than 200,000. We asked for 250 to cover all the postage and all the other gifts and all that stuff. And we ended up with 312. Mm-hmm. So that extra 50 that we ended up making, we paid off all the musicians, a few more licenses. We had a lot more bills than that. But we ended up we were able to go back and recut and bring Leon Russell into the picture. We were able to do a 5-1 sound mix and mm-hmm. things like that. And we continued. Even till a month and a half ago, I think I paid my last license.
Well, I remember at NAMM, you were still trying to get some of the people. And you were even telling me that to try to find somebody that would, authorize even to pay. We were talking about the Wild Wild West, I think it was. Nobody ever responded.
Yeah, it's weird because we have 110 songs in the film.
Wow, that's a lot. Yeah,
a lot of songs.
A lot of cues.
And no one ever gave us a problem. I mean, it just took time. There was a couple, problems, but I won't mention names because,
it's cool.
Yeah.
There
was single people. No one even knows who these people are. thank God the guy only had one song, and he was such a jerk about it. But, sooner or later, we got it out. But overall, it was not that bad. The labels and the publishers were not really a problem. It was just, how do you deal with a guy when I'm getting such a low rate? Mm-hmm. Why are they going to deal with me when they're trying to make money for the company?
Right.
Sooner or later, they had to come around and say, okay, fine. But he had to be patient. If my father taught me anything, he says, don't blow up on the leader. That was one thing he always taught me. And, man, I could have blown up a lot of times. And, it would have bit me in the butt.
Well, that's the thing, too, is but a lot of the songs have – I've heard people that are doing films, when it's better to use older music because it's already taken its course and you usually get a better price sometimes.
It depends. I mean, if someone wants to jack you up, if you want to do good vibrations.
Well, yeah, that's.
Or if you want to, it depends on, it doesn't matter. If they feel they're going to make money off you, it's really the personality on the other, mm-hmm. on the other side. Yeah, you don't want to go for the hit song right now. And if you can't tell the story without that song, you better be careful. A lot of the biggest problem with filmmakers is when they write something into a film, and they have a whole, they just assume they're going to be able to have them sing along in the car. Well, that's stupid because then you're stuck. You got no way out.
Yeah. No, it's a lot more complicated. I remember asking, this was years ago, I met Dick Clark.
Yeah.
And he had done all those Dick Clark shows. I'm like, will we ever see those on video? And he said, no. And he said, it's not because of me. It's because just trying to relicense all of that and get all of the everybody paid, it's a nightmare.
I think the problem, and we live in a society. And, and Don has seen – Don is a little older than us. Yeah. Wake up, Don. It's time to talk. Everybody thinks everything – we're going to make a killing. There's no killing to be made anymore, guys.
Yeah.
Let's try to work together and come up with a medium that we all can work with. But also, don't expect for things for free. Why should – I think the biggest – and I'll never forget. Remember, Don, when we went to the NAMM show and it was a guy comes up to us and says, man, I love the film. I love the film. And Don knew him. And we won't mention his name, but he was a teacher at MI, of course. And it was like – and he goes – and I said, well, that's cool. I said, where'd you see the film? He says, oh, I couldn't wait, man. I had to download it. I went – and at this point
– whoa.
We were still trying to raise money. It's like, I gave him a donation card. Here, make a donation. But it's like the musicians are killing themselves. No more, just as much as every filmmaker. You guys get, every time you download something for free, or share an app or just do this. No one's
Well, even some of it, it's not like a friend of mine, his new album came out, and the next day it was out there free.
It's crazy.
And he didn't authorize it. It wasn't something he gave away. No. It's just the black market, the way it works.
Don, what was the guy? Remember that you wrote a piano book? Remember you said the guy was so upset because he made very little money and all this stuff was downloaded?
Oh, I can't remember his name yet, but that actually did happen.
What was it? Do you remember? But it was so disturbing.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, a lot of people think that music should be free. And there was somebody that made a comment about that. It was a country singer, and he said, it's interesting, on iTunes or whatever, you can buy this app that's totally ridiculous, Like he had said, some just ridiculous joke app that makes weird sounds or whatever,
right.
And it's more expensive than a song. And it's interesting to think. I mean, we're, wow.
Well, you know what it is, too? I think they missed the whole possibility completely. When it first started, when CDs first started, they had a golden opportunity to put all those things in motion so that they can't be downloaded. They could have done that with all the technology that's around. But greed took over, and everybody started fighting with one another, one record company, another record company. And pretty soon, everybody didn't care till they finally had to care because everybody was losing so much money.
Yeah.
Well, that life, I'm ignorant of a lot of this stuff, but like when that Napster thing was happening, the record company should have been charging downloads. They should have been doing all that. They could have made money.
Yeah, they didn't.
They should have made that decision right then and there. This is the way it's going to be.
There's an interesting thing about video. This was years ago. And Paramount discovered this. Let's go way back. I mean, way before your time. No, just kidding. When VHS came out and Star Wars came out, when the first VHS movies came out, they rented them at first because to buy them, they were like $150 or whatever.
Right.
It was around that amount of price. So people were, copying them like crazy. And for a long time, they were $80. And they started going down a little bit, but they were pretty high up. And then all of a sudden, Paramount released Indiana Jones, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, and they put it down at $29.95.
To buy?
Buy, brand new.
Right.
And they noticed something really interesting. Pirating dropped. They had less people copying because it was cheaper. It wasn't really that. It was a hassle to copy it.
Yeah.
But they could get a good copy for a reasonable price. Yeah. And they found that was the price barrier. And later it came down to like $19.95 and people wouldn't. And the same thing started happening with, I think, one of the problems with CDs. If you look, you can buy a DVD, an older one, for $5. You can buy a Blu-ray now for $5.
Yeah.
It's not worth it to copy it because you got it. I mean, it's less hassle.
It's weird. And I have a, there was a guy that was a friend, family, not a family, well, he was a friend, but whatever. He was in the business and working for one of the major companies, and he would download stuff. I was like, dude, that's your company. He wasn't obviously in the film part of the business, but he worked.
Right.
And it's like, and it just drove me crazy. Because they don't understand there is a cost. And it's not obvious to you right now, but there is a cost. Less engineers, less, it goes right around the corner, everybody gets hit.
It's absolutely a cost. That's why I'm not in California anymore.
It's expensive, but I mean, but I think part of the demise, and there's been articles about this too, of the record companies, was because, some people were charging $15 to $17 for a, old technology you could buy a DVD for half or less than half that price.
It's greed.
It was greed. They killed themselves.
Yeah.
Because I think if the CDs were cheaper and, manufacturing costs were like 25 cents.
Yeah.
So if they charged, when they started bringing them, like Tom Petty was one of the guys that started forcing them to lower the prices.
Right.
Down. When they started coming down to like $9 and stuff, it wasn't as big of a deal. People wanted,
Well, it's interesting is Magnolia is the production company or the distributor for my film. And the big thing was, you're negotiating with them and this and that. We're talking about DVDs. Well, DVDs not much of a market now. Mm-hmm. And I said, guys, you got to give me this. I said, I promise you if there is a market for this movie. Mm-hmm. Because I said, for 18 years, I've been actually, filming everybody. There's hours and hours and hours of outtakes. And they finally came around, realized this was a different project. And mm-hmm. it was going to be released on a DVD and Blu-ray for that reason, because you could put more content on it and handle it. The folks that download it, they can download it and they'll get parts of the outtakes for less price.
Well, now at Films, it's expected to have a director's cut. It's expected to release the DVD with the extended.
Well, but DVDs are dead. That's what they're saying. DVDs are like on their way out.
Even Blu-ray is supposedly on their way out.
But that's what I'm saying. It's in terms of the. But unfortunately for me, I was able to convince them, and I hope to prove them right, or myself right, that it was worth doing.
Yeah. No. I mean it. I think that's the coolest thing about and let's talk about that a little bit now. Over this 2-year expanse since we saw you last time. You started picking up more stuff. Did you find more footage?
Oh, yeah.
Did you find more? And then did you do more interviews?
Yeah, we did. I mean, we continued. I mean, we always have. Everybody has the interviews on their own. Like Don Randy, Don. We have his interviews, and we did Leon Russell, and then the last interview I did within a week of turning in my footage to Magnolia for the DVD was Michael Nesmith to discuss the date that Don was on, which is
the Wichita train whistle.
Yeah.
I'll play that clip. Yeah. We have a clip.
That's right. We have that.
Well, let's play that. You titled it The Flying Telecaster.
James Burton's talking on it. Don's on it, right? I think I remember.
Yeah. Well, I'll play it. You tell me who everybody is that was on it, because there's a bunch of people. And then you have the actual recording of it.
Yeah. So you'll hear the story. But that was like one of those things where Mike Nesmith for years never wanted to be interviewed. I was like, all right, well, whatever. And then I wanted to do this outtake, and I didn't expect – I just wanted to use the song. I had to go back and license a song. And I realized, oh, my God, all the songs I licensed – for just the outtakes. I'm like, oh my God, that's somebody else's budget. Yeah. It's still coming out of my pocket. I never quit. Don't tell my wife. We didn't tell her I'm on tonight, did we?
Well, okay, here's the clip. Let's take a listen.
Do you remember that guitar that you had? You had dollar signs written on it, and you had, you had the answering service phone number.
The session we did with Mike Nesmith, what was the name of the album? You might remember Wichita. Train whistle or something. Anyway, it was a weekend project.
I asked somebody, I said, I'm interested in what it would be to have my songs played by a big band. And they said, well, you hire an orchestrator. And then I taught myself about that. What's an orchestrator? And they said, well, I said, do you know any? He said, yeah, Shorty Rogers plays trumpet and he orchestrates and he does a bunch of session work. I said, can he put together like a big band? He said, he had one of the great big bands. So I called him up and I said, look, I've got a half a dozen or maybe a dozen songs and I want to arrange them. They're kind of country-ish right now and I want to arrange them for big band. Can you help me out? And he said, sure, I'd love to do it.
Mike called me and said, I'm booked in the studio. I got 60, 70 musicians. Everybody's on it. You and Tommy and everybody.
I waited till the end of soon. It was Shorty Rogers wrote the charts.
Mike came over and said to Tommy, Shorty wouldn't know how to tell you this. So I'm going to tell it to you, He says, just when you get to this one spot, I want you to do something so different and so outrageous. Just do it. So Tommy just sat there and he's looking. And we didn't know what he was going to do. And we're all sitting in the big orchestra row. And
doing a solo. It comes to me. I'll play my solo and just freak out, play some wild stuff. And it came to Tommy's time. Nobody had any idea what each other was going to do. And Tommy, just for what reason, he did the unexpected. He turned his guitar wide open and he hit the craziest chord.
All of a sudden, we see this guitar go flying through the air, still hooked up. The wire was still in, the cord was still there, and it broke away, and that RCA Victor flew through the air, and then bang!
And it hit the floor and just broke into a thousand pieces, and that was the most ungodly sound.
I saw a little tail end of it. I looked up just as it was coming down. It was just as it was coming down, I looked up, and I thought, what the heck? And then kapow.
We were in hysterics. We couldn't believe that Tommy had done that, but it was great.
And Tommy, standing ovation. That was incredible. And nobody expected this.
All of a sudden they asked, and this was before it was the three-year guitar.
Yeah, right.
Then gradually they went back to the music. So later, when the album came out, sure enough, it was all in there.
Left it on.
They left it on, and they interviewed Mike Nesmith in New York one time. Somebody sent me this clipping. Mike says, I was just out in California, did this Wichita song,
Whistle
or something. He says, there was one creative guy there was a guitar player, Tommy Tedesco. You know? And I was just being my usual self, just doing something for craziness, you know. But that was a guitar.
Oh, that was funny. That's all coming.
But it didn't come out anything like I wanted it to come out. It was completely wrong. And I made one of the great Hollywood blunders in terms of production that you can make. I had it catered. And when I had it catered, I had a bar. I said, well, you know, people want to have a drink. I had no idea people were going to get falling down drunk and couldn't play.
That's great.
Can you imagine, Larry Nechtel and I were pianists, and we're sitting behind where the guitar section is, and we're at RCA Victor, that giant studio. And you have, it's like a basketball court, so you really have a high ceiling.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would have never been able to be done. And when we saw that guitar go up, I mean, we were like, oh my God.
Where did he throw it? Did he throw it to the side, or
no,
did he throw it
straight up?
In the air?
In the air, straight up in
over
the air.
Over the baffle?
Well, I don't think there was a baffle in front of them.
Okay.
I don't think there was a baffle. It just went straight
up. So towards the conductor.
Well, Shorty was off to the side.
Oh, okay.
But what you didn't hear in that thing was Shorty conveying that, hey, man, could you kind of do something a little different? Because he was the essence of Mr. Cool. You know?
Oh, okay.
Mr. Bebop.
That's just a classic.
So that's what James Burton talking about it, Don Randy, obviously. Don was with Nancy, and then who else was on the? Michael Nesmith talking.
Who was the woman at the beginning?
That's Carol Kay.
Carol Kay.
Yeah,
okay.
Talking about it. But yeah, like I said, Mike Nesmith was the last interview. I thought was the last interview was the month before, where I pulled in Billy Davis and Marilyn McCoo. You know, these are people I tried for years to get to. You know, and the only people that really turned us down, when I say turned me down, were groups that contemporary people. You know, I went to the people, and who knows who turned me down, like Tom Petty. I would love Tom Petty to say something. Well, Tom Petty, you know, they turned me down. Well, maybe it wasn't Tom that turned me down. His people turned me down.
Yeah.
You know, it was the same thing with Bonnie Raitt's people, and the same thing with Max Weinberg. I would have loved for Max to talk about Al and Earl. But they turned it, but that's okay. In the end, there was a lot of things, actually, I think. It was all timing to turn things down. It worked out perfect. You know, the other one, I don't know if I told you, Don, I thought about this the other day. Everybody always wonders, hey, did you always try to get Phil Spector? Of course I tried to get Phil Spector for many years. I realize now that was a blessing in disguise. If Phil had been in the film, there would have been a gasp in the film when people saw it, because Phil's, you know, what he did was so, you know, just horrific. It just would have taken people out of the picture, you know, so we didn't have to go down that road with Phil being in the picture. We knew what Phil, you know, as a
well, you guys all told us what he did. I mean, you were explaining in the session.
Yeah, so that was fine, you know, so there's a lot of things that worked out perfectly in terms of timing.
What was like the special one that like really was like the coolest thing that you felt in terms of getting that scoring an interview or footage, or whatever? What was like the really highlight for you?
You know, I think there was so many of them, but I think it was really, but for me, it was because you live with something for so long. It's like saying to you, like, how many times they asked you, what's your favorite song?
You know, it's so hard to ask, to answer. But, you know, for me, watching Denny's process over all these years, and also being a part of the thing, he's got to be the guy with the most courage in the world, because how many times you could have turned away from this project? He didn't. He stayed.
Yeah, you had a lot of stuff that happened, obstacles along the way.
And he climbed every one of them. And his family, just to be so supportive of him. Of course, Master Charge Visa and everybody else loves him, you know.
They still love me. They still love me with that percentage at Higher Point.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. But I think it's funny because, can we say how old you are now?
Sure, you can.
How old are you?
78.
Okay.
You're just a youngster.
I thought he was going to lie. 32. I would have lied. 32. He looks amazing.
And he still plays. Yeah. You know,
absolutely.
You say
he packed the house yesterday. It was
Friday night. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's all attitude, but it's like you're hipper than a lot of people that are half my age.
That is the coolest thing to watch these guys.
You know, playing in nightclubs as long as I have, besides doing all the records, what's amazing to me is that I know too many songs, because I'll get some young guys in the band, mm-hmm. and whereas they may know some of the standards that I can play, but what I really get shocked at is if I'll play a Beatles tune and they don't know what I'm playing. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh my God, am I that old?
Yeah. You know. Well, you mean McCartney's, he was in that band before he was in Wings or whatever.
But I think the Leon Russell for me was the last thing we added. I think that was fun because Leon turned it down for so many times, and then Don worked on him, mm-hmm. and a few other people kind of worked on him. It was like, and then he came around, and it was like, okay. And then it was like, oh, what do we do? I fly to Nashville, and it's like, what if he's horrible? What if he's now? What do I do? You know.
Well, I presume you showed him the film, and what did he? How did he react to it? How did those guys? That, you know, when you were, because you had to show it to him to see what it was.
You know, he must have, his guitar player, Pat Flynn, showed it to him. So he was pushing him on that end. So his problem with it, which, hey, was fine. His problem was, and he says, we were never called the Wrecking Crew. That's a bunch of BS, blah, blah, blah. That's fine. That's not what I needed Leon for. And I can agree with him as well. I mean,
I sat with him for 2.5 hours and I said, you have to realize that the name has become such a great iconic name that even people that would have never thought of us like that now think of us like that, and you can't fight it.
Yeah.
It's just a good moniker.
Sure it is.
You just Google the Wrecking Crew, and it's like, yeah, it's these guys that played on all the – I mean, it's you're now known by that.
What do you do when it's on Jeopardy?
Yeah, was the best. That's when we knew we.
Then you know.
Then we hit. Then we really created a monster.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Don, about some of the. You did some pretty interesting sessions too, and your roster. I was on your website, and it's just amazing. I have to ask you, because I'm a big fan of them, is your session work with Buffalo Springfield.
It was amazing, and because they were great to work with, especially Neil Young. Mm-hmm. Neil and I came. Pretty much became very friendly because of Jack Nitzsche, who was the arranger, and it was a very tight-knit thing. And I think Neil, when he started doing solo stuff too, was you could see that this is where it's going to end up. He was a great writer and so musical. My goodness.
So you worked on the second album, because
my favorite cut that I ever did for them was with Broken Arrow.
Broken Arrow.
And they, at the end, I think it'd still be going on if they didn't say, okay, that's it.
But you did his first solo album, which I think was recorded at the same time.
Sure.
Now, did you just come in and overdub, or did you do section? They had a whole section there.
There was a whole. The band was there.
Their band.
Their band. Right. Some of them. Oh, okay. And once in a while, we'd add somebody to it.
So Neil did all the guitars, or did he have any of the Wrecking Crew in there?
Some of the Wrecking Crew were in there too. I think your dad might have. No, he didn't do that.
I don't think so.
But I know there were other guitar players there too.
What about the bass? Was it?
That's a good question.
Was Osborne or one of those guys, or Carroll?
I don't think it was Carroll. It might have been Lyle Ritz, as a matter of fact. But I don't know for sure.
Oh no, he did both sometimes.
Yeah.
Now another one that you did talk a little bit, because we were talking a little bit before the show, was you did some stuff for Elvis Presley. And what a lot of people don't realize, too, is when he had done a lot of stuff in Memphis, his original stuff, but when he was doing the movies out here, it was the Wrecking Crew that was – you guys were just cranking out these songs for the movies, right?
Sure. We were on a – usually there was a budget. They had to get us in to do the tracks and get it over with Otherwise, it costs more and more and more money. And it was very, it was so much fun. And Elvis was, you know, he was a mensch. He was really cool to be with.
Mm-hmm.
And the song A Little Less Conversation from one of the films wasn't in the film. Mac Davis and Billy Strange were the writers on that. Mm-hmm. They had written a number of other songs. And they said, guys, take a 10-minute break. We got to write another song. But we took a break, and we came back 20 minutes later. And they had a possibility of what the song was, a good possibility. And we actually, I think, made it up on the bandstand. Mm-hmm. All the different changes, not so much the chord changes, but the structure. We'd stop, we'd start, and believe it or not, within 15 to 20 minutes, mm-hmm. we had a little mm-hmm. less conversation.
Wow.
Which was not a hit afterwards. It didn't happen till years later when all of a sudden everybody realized that was a good song, and then somebody else covered it, and somebody else
covered
it.
Well, they remixed it.
Or remixed it, too.
The famous remix in Europe.
And guess what?
Blew up.
We all got paid again. As a new use because it was... Because
they went to Casino.
Yeah, oh, that
was it. Now, the show? Was it Vegas or Casino? Whatever the show
Vegas.
Was.
Vegas.
Where were you guys recording? Were you were at the RCA building up on Sunset, or were you at the one that became Thorne Noger's down over by?
No, this was at the motion where we were.
MGM.
MGM, I think it was.
Their soundstage.
Soundstage. It was either there or at Warner Brothers, I think.
And you worked on the Monkees, right? Too.
Some of the Monkees.
Was that done there too, or did you go to what? Because I think Neil Young you did at Gold Star, right?
No, Neil Young we did at Sunset Sound.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That was Sunset Sound, Tutti Camerata's studio. A great studio.
Yeah. No, I the last time we were here, I had mentioned that I had done a session there years ago, and I was a little kid, and the engineer took me in the back, and they just had the first 8-track in the U.S. just came in. They just took it out of the box. It hadn't even been wired in.
Oh.
It was
kind of cool. Was it Sunset?
Sunset Sound.
Wow.
So... And I met the Fifth Dimension, too. A vocal coach that I worked with.
What were you doing as a kid?
We used to sing, and we used to do USO shows and all sorts of stuff when I was really young.
Fantastic.
My dad was like, he'd drive us everywhere.
Oh, that's funny.
But Renee DeKnight, who used to work with the Fifth Dimension, and Carl Jones, who used to coach Shirley Bassey, they were my vocal coaches.
Oh, wow.
So I met them very early on. I was like, you know, I was a little kid. But
they were
great.
Amazing. I mean... I listen to those albums, and those are if someone said, "What album do you want?" That's my album is that album, the best of the Fifth Dimension, because they're so beautiful. You know, great, amazing singers, amazing arrangements. You know, all the way around.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, the Up and Away thing was just a classic, and that they had just recorded that. I don't think it had broken when I met them.
Oh, so that was really early.
It was really early, but yeah, it was up. They had an office up on Highland,
That was when Johnny Rivers was still producing.
Yeah, Johnny Rivers was
because he's the one that brought him in originally.
Yeah. Now let's play, since we're talking about the Fifth Dimension. Let's play a clip. The one with Aquarius is the one that has Joe Osborne playing.
Yeah,
the
Joe Osborne ends it with Joe Osborne playing.
Right, he's playing along with the clip as they show, so you can get an idea of his style, because he had he did a lot of notes, but it works, and it's kind of an interesting thing, and it was very, it was part of that sound of that time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to play this clip. This is the Fifth Dimension talking about Aquarius.
Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis.
We were working at the Americana Hotel, just going shopping. And coming home, I lost my wallet in the cab. You're in New York, you ain't gonna never get it back now. So about an hour later, we get a phone call from a guy, and he says, "Is this Billy Davis Jr.?" I said, "Yes, it is." He said, "I got your wallet." He gave me his address. I went over to him, and I invited him over to see his show, you know, to see our show at the Americana. He came over, him and his wife, and they saw the show. He came backstage, he came upstairs, and he said, "Boy, we really love the show." He said, "Billy, since you were so nice to invite us to your show, I'd like to invite you to our show." I said, "Well, what show is that?" Come to find out, he was one of the producers of Hair. We had been trying to get in to see Hair. There were no seats, there were no tickets, there were no nothing, and he got us in. His name was Ed Gifford.
The moment came when Ronnie Dyson sang Aquarius, and we were like, "Oh my God, that song is so incredible."
What a voice.
So when we got together at intermission, all five of us came together and said, "We have to record
that
song. We have to record that song. It's going to be a hit."
Yeah.
So we called Bones.
So I listened to the song and I went, it doesn't sound like a song to me. It sounds like a piece of a show, but it's not a complete song. To me, it's not a complete song.
He said, you know, that song's already been recorded and released about 3 times and nobody's had a hit on it. And he said, the Fifth Dimension didn't record it.
So I get tickets and I go to see the show. I see these people come out and they sing this tune, and then the show begins, and I go, oh, no wonder, it's the introduction to the show. What if we put this together with something? What if we start with Aquarius and we put something on the end of it? So if we could just find maybe a gospel piece to put on the end of this. And I began thinking about the show where they sing this song called The Flesh Failures. But the last 3 bars of the song was, let the sun shine in, let the sun shine in, the sun shine in. And then they repeat, let the sun shine in, the sun shine in, the sun shine in.
Bone said to Billy, okay, Billy, now go in the studio and take it to church. If you listen to our albums and you heard many of Billy's leads, you would hear the gospel influence in the leads that he was singing. But in the actual hit songs that the group had released, that was the first time that Billy's gospel background was really featured.
And I kept thinking, if I could find a gospel song so that it was like part of this thing that the Fifth Dimension wanted to also be seen. You know, they didn't want to be seen as like a black group that wants to sound white.
We just started out pop, and a lot of people didn't know, hadn't seen us, so they automatically thought we were a white group.
It was frustrating.
Yeah, it was frustrating. Yeah,
it was frustrating because we used to say our line would be, how do you color a sound?
Yeah.
You know, if you're black, do you have to sound like you came from the church? Yeah. And if you're white, you can have any sound you want to have.
It's great because you get to hear what he's doing. I mean, it's kind of an interesting riff that he's doing in there, and it's very syncopated, but that was part of that sound back then.
Joe is an amazingly talented person. I mean, even as we speak, he's recording.
Yeah, he was going to be here tonight with us. And he's actually lives in Shreveport.
Yeah.
But he's here doing a Richard Carpenter.
So he's working with, and he was one of the guys, I was reading on his page that he discovered and encouraged the Carpenters to become a group and do their thing, which is pretty amazing. Did you play on the Carpenters session?
No, Larry Necklin.
I always get you guys. I know Larry was he was the guy most probably I identify him most with Bridge Over Troubled Water, and he also played for Bread, a lot of the Bread stuff.
But he was also part of Bread.
Yeah, he played. But he played guitar. He did the wah guitar on Guitar Man.
And then
he played bass too.
Yeah,
he played bass. And most people don't realize, besides being a great pianist, bassist, and guitar player, he also was a great harmonica player.
Wow.
I mean, he could really play. I mean, not just, you know, just to blow some notes. He could play.
He could play.
He's the bass player on Mr. Tambourine Man with the Birds.
Yep,
because it's Leon Russell, Hal Blaine, Bill Pittman, Jerry Cole, and Larry Nechtel on bass.
Okay,
so I mean he's an all around guy.
You know, it's always funny for me when we would be working dates, and Larry would come in and play bass on one of my dates that I was doing, and you know, we were in safe hands. He was such a fine musician.
Well, when you were doing the Phil Spector thing, where you had like 3 guitar players, several keyboardists. Did you guys just talk among yourself who's going to play what?
Pretty much so.
We
divided it up. Phil, you know, because I was there from the beginning, I kind of knew what he wanted. One guy would be up on the upper end of one piano, a guy in the middle, a guy down lower, somebody on an electric piano.
Right.
To give it all those different, one guy would play it. Gold Star had a great tap piano. somebody.
Would they have you do the organ stuff, or would they bring in a guy that specifically played organ?
Sometimes I did organ stuff. Sometimes I played piano. I played more of everything than the Hammond B3 that they would use.
Okay.
But I did a lot of it, though. You know, when you think back, you were switching back and forth all the time. And that's what made the dates very interesting.
Yeah.
And we used to, at Capitol, they had that Wurlitzer, that old Wurley.
Yeah.
That we did on many of Lou Rawls dates.
Well, if I'm correct, it was the Wurlitzer you used on Old Laughing Lady in the Neil Young album.
Could very possibly be.
It didn't sound like a rose.
Hey, Don, on the when you did those Phil Spector dates, did they have enough tracks to actually individually track each instrument, or did they have to actually mix those down?
Well, that was the amazing thing. All those early hits was mono. There was one track. That was it.
Yeah, that's right. Because at that time, they didn't. Four track was just coming out in like mid 60s. It wasn't really that.
And the only two track was on the 7.5 IPS or the 15 IPS, you know, those old TX.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it was, what can I say? It was all done that way.
And a lot of it, too, that the way. It was the arrangements, but it was also the room. Leakage and how they put that together was that wall of sound.
Also, for guitar players, Phil Spector knew the guitar probably as well as any other producer I've ever worked for, if not better.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that I think he learned a lot of stuff from was a country producer and pop producer, Lee Hazelwood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Phil could have the capacity, and that's why Tommy liked him so much. He could say, look, I need you to play it on this fret. Can you guys play it over here on this one? And Barney Kessel, can you put a capo on? So you would have it. And if Barney didn't want to do it, Tommy would say, I'll do it. And just play. Because that's the way Tommy was. But that's how it happened. And he could explain that to the guitar player. Howard Roberts was the only one that ever had a problem with him.
Well, in the film, Howard finally had it with him because Phil was giving Howard a hard time. Play it like this, play it like this. And he said, finally, give it. Why don't you play it then? Now, the background of that is Howard taught Phil how to play guitar. So he's one of his teachers. So at that point, it's like, F you, I'm out of here. And he just had it with Phil. But let you go back to the, you go talking about the tracks. Larry Levine, who was the guy that did all the mixing and all the recording there, he said at one point we had so many microphones, we ran out of basically mics. And he said, that fourth guitar player is not even on a microphone. Why don't we just send him home? We got nothing to plug in on him. We have no more room. He said, no, everything's set. Don't move. Because he was freaky about the room tone. You didn't want to move a mic, right?
Yeah, he was aware of the leakage was the key of that sound.
Sure. A lot of that stuff, that's the way it worked. And one of the rhythm players that would be there a lot of the times was a young kid by the name of Russ Titelman,
mm-hmm.
who turned out to be one of the top producers of all time. And Russ, I still hear from Russ. We contact each other constantly. But he took everything and he was listening and learning the whole time.
It's interesting because the instrumentation, he'd have two or three keyboardists or more, four keyboardists.
Yeah.
And then he had at least three guitar players, sometimes four. Two or three bass players, one upright.
Two.
Two upright and then one playing electric bass.
Right.
And that's, today, most people don't think about that.
Well, I have a question then. If we're down to one track, are we just ping-ponging with the vocalist? How do you do that?
He would. That's exactly what he would do.
We
didn't do the vocals live. He overdubbed the vocals.
Yeah.
We didn't even use a scratch track with Phil. Sometimes, you would have loved to have that, but it didn't matter with him because you were the wall of sound and you knew you were going to be playing those rolling eighths or those 16th notes constantly.
Yeah. No, that's true. That sound, he knew what he wanted. He was a genius in terms of...
Two different songs he did both went into the Library of Congress 2 weeks ago. You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling and Stand By Me.
Oh, wow.
Stand By Me.
Yeah.
Benny King?
Benny King.
Benny King.
He did that.
Yeah.
So Don, with that wall of sound and all those mics, was there a predominant mic that was used back then?
Well, not I had Gold Star. It was a conglomeration of all these different microphones. I remember seeing those. You remember those big old RCA?
The giant
44s?
44s. Yeah, yeah. They used a number of those, but mostly it was whatever was at hand, you know, whatever they could make work.
What's left over.
They just put everything out there.
Sure. But the secret to Gold Star, they had an echo chamber there that nobody ever had, and that was what drew a lot of people to record there. A simple way
I was lucky. I got to see the studio. Yeah. I didn't get to record there. And it was like they had that little, like, those little white panels with holes. And it was just a really plain place, but the room.
You know what he did do? Phil did something that a lot of other people learned from Phil. He always ran tape echo on another machine the same time we were playing, while we were playing, and also using the Gold Star echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess everything made everything a mishmash, you know, to bring everything together.
Yeah, it had a nice overall wet feel that just gave it, you know.
Hey, Don, would you explain the echo chamber for anybody that isn't aware of how that works? Because they're just used to a little pedal that they click.
Yes, I know. It was a giant, well, not a giant room, but a big room in the back that they had, that they ran their, I guess it had a mic in it to run into the studio. And I guess
a speaker or an amplifier is the other end.
Yeah, and it was. I don't know what it was made out of. I think it was
concrete.
Or I was going to say ceramic, but you
know, either concrete or that's the coating they use on pools.
I think Dave
that plastic.
I got a picture, and I'll send it to you. It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
and it's angled. There's nothing. It's nothing square. It's kind of, you know. And Dave Gold, who designed that room. And it's like, to get into it, you had to really get a little hatch, wasn't it?
Yes.
It's not like a door.
It's like a submarine. Yeah.
You know, and I saw a picture of the last day they recorded there was with Maurice Gibb, I think it was. And there's a picture of Dave and Maurice in the echo chamber.
Yeah.
It looks like one of those prison
films.
Well, a
lot of studios, that was their pride and joy. They would try to build one of those, even though they had the electronic, the plate ones and stuff. But that was like a big deal. If you had that chamber, it was like the place to go.
Well, they used the bathroom first.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
That was the first set, though.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time. I want to play this clip because it really, to me, defines Tommy, your dad.
Before you do that, because I know it's a sign out, right?
Yeah, I'll use the clip to play us out because he plays at the end.
Because there's a couple of things I want people to know. You know, our DVD's coming out on, you know, for those folks that didn't. I promise you, Kickstarter fans, it took a long time. You know, it took a long time, and I appreciate you guys hanging in there. But the only reason we never got this thing out is we never had all the licensing done until a couple months ago. I could never do that. And also, once we picked up distribution, we always needed to keep this thing alive, was a theatrical, which was amazing. We had they were only going to give us 5 cities and went to 175 theaters around the world. But the delay gave us a time to put those 6.5 hours, I think it is, of extras on that DVD or the Blu-ray, whatever they, you know.
Yeah, it's like 4 times the length of the
I mean,
film.
So that's
really cool.
It's huge, and that is so important to the story. You know,
well, to your defense too, you explain, because I've been following, because I did the Kickstarter for the DVD, and you were always saying, okay, this is what's happening. We got distribution. We're going to do this. You had to release it theatrically. Yeah.
And I was an idiot. Believe me, when I gave that time point, I said we ended Kickstarter in December, and I said June of 2015. I meant June 2016, didn't I? Because that's where I'm at. I mean, how could I have ever even thought of June 2015? It took me 18 years at that point to get to. I don't know why I said that. But it was like, because
you honestly thought you were going to have it all.
Well, I think I was so frustrated at that end, said that's going to be it. I'm done at that point. I'm going to get it out. Well, I couldn't get it out, to be honest with you, because I still had to do it.
No, I think,
I had to do it right.
I have to
legally.
Applaud you. You did it right. You did get everybody paid, which I think is really cool. And then also too, I think, you know, from what I saw of the posts and the emails that you were sending, you kept people appraised. You weren't BSing anybody.
Will you tell that to that guy?
Yeah, I remember that one guy was spawny. He was really angry. But it's like, Now, you got 3 extra hours of bonus. I don't care. For the extra year, you got all this extra stuff.
The same price.
Yeah.
So they promise you.
So anyway.
And then Don's got his book coming out in September.
Oh, tell me more about that.
I wrote a book called You've Heard These Hands.
Okay.
And it tells of my early life growing up in upstate New York in the Catskill Mountains to present day to right now. And I go through all the recording dates, all the incredible times with Phil Spector and everybody else.
When's that going to be coming out?
September 1st.
But you can do pre-orders now. It's on pre-order now on Amazon.
Amazon, yeah.
And you could do the DVD or the Blu-ray now on pre-order on WreckingCrewFilm.com.
The Blu-ray was, they announced it about a month ago. I already had pre-ordered.
Yeah, so I mean, that's, you know, that's the amazing thing.
Yeah.
So,
is that going to be on Kindle or is that just going to be a book?
I don't know, but it's a book. It'll probably be on everything. It's Hal Leonard Music that's published.
Yeah, it'll be there.
Because I'm going to get that.
You're going to enjoy it. Anybody who enjoyed the music of the 60s, 70s also, and 80s, but mostly the 60s, they'll love the book.
It's amazing how people are just loving this material now.
Well, before we go to the clip, real quick, what's next for you?
I'm finishing up. I'm going to London to show the film in London, and that's in June. And then I'm just going to basically fill these orders and move on.
Do you have another project? You're going to do another music project, or are you going to do something totally different?
I got to do something totally different. I mean, listen, I just can't put my family and friends through this again. I just can't do that. There's a book that I'm actually distributing now called Sound Explosion by Ken Sharp and Mark London did the design, and that's a tabletop book, 12 by 12 inch, 300 pager. It's gorgeous, and that's actually about the Wrecking Crew. So
Really cool. Yeah. No, when's that?
That's at WreckingCrewFilm.com as well.
Oh, okay.
It's out now.
Yes, and they got cool stuff. And we forgot to mention real quick.
What?
Sign up for the drawing.
Oh, my
for
God,
the,
yeah.
And Scott, especially you, they got a special Wrecking Crew tube screamer.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a
Boston. I'm only a son of a guitar, but I have no idea what that
is. It's a tube screamer with the whole the special artwork.
Right. It's really cool
and
from Boss. Cool.
Sign up. I already signed up, and I let them know.
And if there's green involved, someone could win really easily.
Incidentally, for all of you guitar...
You take checks, I can pay for the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right now. For all you guitar players, I was in a studio one time knowing very little about the electronic stuff, and something was wrong with a guy's amp, a little Fender Twin. And he just couldn't get it to work right, and he kicked it. And that was the first fuzz tone. And the producer heard it and said, please, don't change anything.
Don't change it.
And I said, are you kidding me? Nope, that was it.
Yeah. No, that's true. I heard Davey Allen, the Arrows, his sound, he slit the cone with a razor blade, and that's how he got his sound.
God.
So,
so easy.
Unbelievable. All right, we're going to end with this clip with Tommy talking about classical guitar. And it's an interesting clip. And then he plays at the end. So you get an idea. Because he was talking about the flack that he would get from some of the purists. The legit guys. So I'm going to leave it with that. Denny, thank you so much.
Thank you again,
Don,
guys.
It's a pleasure. We got to do more. We'll try to follow up. Even though it's a guitar show, I'm going to take a look at this book of yours, and we might have some interesting stories on that. And Denny, keep us posted,
thank you,
and we'll have you back, too.
We'll see you soon.
But anyway, I'm going to play this clip. Everybody have a great day and a great week, but this is really great. This is Tommy talking.
It was kind of funny. I started out many years ago. A lot of you noticed that I was using a pick on a classical guitar. Well, it was kind of funny. This happened to me years ago. I got a call. I was here. I was working at a warehouse, making $1.60 an hour. So I'll never forget, a guy called, and I remember he called Barney Kessel, you play classical guitar? Barney says, no. He called Howard Roberts, you play classical guitar? He said, no. Tedesco, you play classical guitar? Well, I ain't stupid, sure. I said, yes. And immediately, I figured, well, so I showed up, and here's me and Lorenzo Almeida going like this. Right after that, sure enough, they called Barney Kessel, you play classical guitar? No. Howard Roberts, you play classical guitar? Tedesco. Sure. Now I'm with Elmer Bernstein doing a Marlboro commercial. I started loving classical music right at the time. It was gas. I started loving all this stuff. But the main thing, and I've been doing that for years, doing all these movies, and the only guys I get in trouble with are the authentic, classical guitar societies of the country. And they're always seeing me, and they first come up, and they keep seeing me. I think you're one of them over there. I can see one of the classical authentic guitar. I mean, I just feel it over there, right? First thing they do, and I'm over there, first thing they ask is, why do you use a pick? And I always answer them, because I don't have my shovel. Okay. Next thing they want to know, they say, well, how come you constantly change the composer's notes? And I said, well, I play better guitar than most composers I've been around. Oh, boy, they hate it. You can't do that to a classical guy. He hates to hear that. You know? The third thing is they ask, and another thing, they said, you aren't playing the guitar right. You should use it on your lap. And I tell them I ain't had a lap in 28 years. You know, in fact, I got about 3 more inches here, and then I go into retirement, you know. But in the meantime, I'm going to dedicate this tune that I just wrote. I'm going to dedicate it to the authentic classical guitar player, the music purist, the guitar society. The only thing is I wrote the piece, so it's written strictly with pick and fingers in mind, because I'm the composer, preferably a brown pick, and must be played on the knee if possible, you know. So, I mean, this is my style, so I'm going to play a tune of mine. Needless to say, we'll start it that way.